everybody. Welcome to the NFL Roadshow. Following a crazy day of games yesterday, arguably the most fun day of football we've seen all season long. Some wild finishes in the early window. That Chargers-Browns game in the late window, 89 combined points. Cleveland, the first team ever to score 40-plus points, not turn the ball over, and not get a win. As for the Chargers, you already know about my fan club aspirations for Justin Herbert. Happy to welcome many of you as new members this week. Now that we're having conversations about whether we trade him for Patrick Mahomes, I've seen two separate conversations about that on Twitter since the end of that game. Think we might want to settle down just a bit on that one, but yes, I agree. He is amazing. And so is Brandon Staley. The more I learn about him as a coach, the more I love his aggressive approach to going forward on fourth, the way he talks about the game. There was a clip that made its way around last week about pressures being more telling than sacks. He's just smart and so up for the task, and I hope LA fans know how lucky they are. We are, I'm an LA fan, to have two teams with the leadership that we currently have here in Los Angeles, because I think that we're going to be in for a fun run here. And not for nothing, this is the perfect year to make that push for the fan base, since USC fans are essentially waiting till next year. And I say that as a USC fan that is waiting till next year. Anyway, the Bills, also obviously impressive in that incredibly long Sunday night football game last night with the hour-plus weather delay that the Bills had to suffer through in a small visitor's locker room that we know, thanks to Michelle Tafoya, served PB&J sandwiches with a frustratingly high ratio of peanut butter. Michelle, by the way, I thought did a great job during that break in action. And obviously the Bills did too, able to hold on in the second half and pick up a huge win, now have a two-game lead on the Chiefs, and a head-to-head win, which could wind up being massive in terms of playoff seeding and their efforts to get a week off and also have those games at home. And I think they're looking like the favorite to ultimately wind up with both of those things in the AFC, the number one scoring offense in the NFL and the number one scoring defense. They're only allowing 12.8 points per game. That is incredible. And I know Bills fans are feeling it and that they are very familiar with my guest today, Vic Carucci, one of the absolute giants of Buffalo sports media. In his fifth decade covering the NFL, he's seen it all, and he knows better than anyone what is going on currently in Western New York. But he also has some insights on the rest of the league, too. We're talking Chargers and Chiefs and Vikings. That's less positive. Anyway, let's get started. Time now to break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
Two on two. Ready? Three.
Hi, Vic. It's good to see you. Thank you so much for doing this. I know it's been a crazy long 36 hours or so for you, since you definitely had to stay up through that lightning delay and figure out a way to make it to what hour were you done last night?
Oh, man. So I'm a contributor to the local NBC affiliate in Buffalo. So it's their game and they're making a big deal about it. And I was part of the whole pregame show. And then there's a postgame with all the interviews. And Lindsay, it was crazy. I think at one point, I know it was after 1 a.m. that we were doing stuff on air, and I'm struggling not to look like a sleepy-eyed guy. I don't think that's, I mean, I'd ask a pro like you, but I don't think that's good for TV, right? You shouldn't look like a sleepy-eyed
person. All the coffee, all of it.
All the coffee. And there was a lot of that consumed. But yeah, a long night. And the other funny side story to this was that the meteorologist at the station was working, and she walked into we were in a conference room watching the game on a big screen, and she walked in during the delay and she said, you know, I'm hearing NBC, hearing them say something to the effect of a 10:30 p.m. Eastern time restart. She goes, that's never going to happen. This is going to be well after 11 p.m. based on what she was showing on her Doppler radar. And I said, you know what? She nailed it. She was right.
She was right. Oh my goodness. And you know what's crazy is, I mean, thank goodness I tweeted last night, thank goodness this game is Bills Chiefs from an NBC perspective, because people will actually hang around through this delay, though I'm sure there was still some drop off from a rating standpoint because it just got so late. I bet not there in Buffalo, though. I'd be really interested to see the ratings and see what kind of percentage they still had at the end of the game in Buffalo, because you know they stuck around.
Yeah, and if this is any indication, I think the team finally arrived at close to 5 a.m. ish or so from Kansas City, the charter flight. And there were a fair amount of Bills fans. I know no one should really be surprised by this, but let's think about it. I mean, after a full night, and there are people there standing on the opposite side of the fence after, as these players are coming off the plane, just cheering them on. Yes, it is a game that was, this was the most anticipated game, and probably when you look at the whole schedule, the most anticipated game on the schedule, period. And it was a gold standard match, because you have to go back to what Brandon Bean said, the general manager, in January. The Chiefs are the gold standard. So if we're going to take the step that we need to take, et cetera, this is the barometer. This is who we have to show that we're, you know, climb that mountain. And they built it accordingly with the draft picks, Greg Rousseau and Boogie Basham, those first two picks, right? Defensive ends. You saw with Rousseau, that amazing interception he had, the pressure they put on Patrick Mahomes, because they did it the way the Buccaneers did it in the Super Bowl. Get pressure from your front, drop the safeties back, keep defenders crowded in that secondary, and don't give them any openings. And it really worked to perfection, which shocked me. I did not, I'm not surprised, I'm not surprised the Bills offense moved on that lousy Chiefs defense, but I was stunned to see how the Chiefs struggled so much offensively.
Just one blitz on 63 dropbacks last night. They chose coverage instead, and obviously that ended up being the right call. Only gave up one passing play of 20 plus yards. How much do you think we're taking away from that game? Just in terms of, like, you know, at the beginning of the year, it felt like a little bit of a roller coaster for Josh Allen. We tend to overreact, you know, to what we see in the NFL space. There were murmurs about Josh Allen and whether or not, you know, he'd be able to be the same Josh Allen that he was last year, this year. That's obviously proving to be a little bit premature, that conversation at the beginning of the season. But the fact that they were able to do what they did against this team, they talk about it being one game and not wanting to overreact. And that's obviously the right approach for them. But clearly there's more to it, right? Like, in terms of what we take away, you talking about the fact that it's a hurdle mentally. And I feel like there's a lot that you can build off of that once you kind of get that monkey off your back, so to speak, and then just move forward with that type of confidence.
Well, this is one that I'll give to the fans and media overreactors, what we're supposed to do. And I get that the team's supposed to do what it does and try to maintain calm. And that's for the sake of the players. Don't be so carried away with this game that it becomes what you're thinking about in next week at Tennessee and so on. That's understandable. That's what coaches are supposed to do. Players are supposed to at least mimic that or parrot that.
Right.
But the fact is, this is huge. This is huge. This is defining. This sets the pecking order, I think, of the AFC in a very defining way. Now the Bills are 4-1, but more importantly, you know, they've got that advantage over the Chiefs, the team that, and a lot of folks believe, if that game were in Buffalo, that AFC championship game, that was the number one lament of the Bills, was that they had to go there after winning 13 games in the regular season. They had to go there to get to the Super Bowl. And of course, being there, that's not the only reason they lost playing at Arrowhead, but it's a factor.
Yeah.
Last night, they overcame that demon of they talked about the hostile environment. So it was huge. Yes, you can get carried away because it was that kind of big deal. And yeah, you got to move on and focus on a long season ahead. But to your point about Josh Allen, $258 million, six-year contract extension. All of a sudden, the deserved contract that a lot of people thought he had because of the MVP-like season he had in 2020 was the distraction, right? Is he now thinking too much about that? Is he worth that? He wasn't really a problem because I think the Pittsburgh game, yes, he was not good. And that ultimately, I think, cost them because their offense just – their defense was solid even then, and it's been solid through five games. So he had to be better, but more importantly, everything had to be better, including Brian Daboll, the offensive coordinator. I think they got their act in order over the course of a few games. Josh looked – so there's been two games this year where he's been dominant, Josh, Washington, and then against the Chiefs. And I think all of that stems from a team that is confident in its defense, that has a defense that is the best in the NFL, And they didn't have that last year. And that plus an offense that can quick strike whenever it wants to, or you would think, or more times than not, is a dangerous football team.
Well, Josh Allen's strengths are the reason that they won that game offensively, right? Like the two things, his legs and then that rocket of an arm. He had a perfect passer rating on throws of 20 plus air yards, picked up 213 yards and two touchdowns that way. And then he also led the team in rushing and tied Moss's rush attempts. So he's getting volume, like 11 rush attempts in a game for your quarterback. Is that something that they can maintain? Is that a volatile offense, or is that the recipe that's going to get them where they want to go?
Well, I think there's no ignoring what Josh does as a runner, even if folks get nervous, because anytime he's running, he's the target. He's a bigger target than he probably is in the pocket. So susceptible to the hit that's going to scare the crap out of everybody and maybe end the season if it's the wrong kind of hit. Yet you can't avoid what it means to your offense. And you see Patrick Mahomes do it too. He ran a whole bunch last night, but his were more desperate runs. Josh's, I think, were built into an offense that, as you mentioned too, had him with that rocket arm, making those big throws, big completions. I think they feed off of each other, and you get a mismatch offense versus defense when the quarterback is the ball carrier, because no one is accounted for him. Everybody's accounted for everybody else, but no one's really accounting for him. So then it becomes a free-for-all. And when you're 6'5 and 237 pounds and can run like a smaller, faster guy and can jump over people, which is another thing that's crazy. I think it's a factor that defenses have to not only respect, but it changes what they want to do on a particular play, because everything they plan to do in a given down, and then he goes off this run script. Some are designed, but a lot of them are just, you know, improvised. You are in trouble defensively. You likely are giving up a big chunk play.
Let me ask you about Dawson Knox, because it feels like they're using him differently than they did last year. And maybe that's just at first glance, and I haven't watched every single play of theirs, but it feels like last year they used him primarily in the red zone, and then this year they're using him more between the 20s. What's the thought process behind that? What are you seeing with him and his usage?
I think it appears that way, Lindsay. I'm not so sure it's true that he wasn't someone they wanted to utilize in between the red zones. He just is playing better. And that, I think you're seeing just more production from a guy who can be trusted more. When they throw to him in those other areas, often he would drop the ball. Often he would just not get open the way they wanted him to, and not make the plays that they wanted him to, because they had high expectations for him. And it's such an interesting story, because only days after that AFC Championship game loss, Brandon Bean is talking to reporters and says flat out, we don't have a tight end that basically scares opponents the way other teams do. He was talking about Travis Kelce, who had just, you know, just shredded the Bills in that game. And that was the warning. That was the alarm going off to Dawson Knox. You better get your act together. And then there was a lot of buzz in the offseason that maybe they were going to trade for Zach Ertz, unhappy guy in Philly, right? That never happened. So what did Knox do? Knox basically just went back to the drawing board, so to speak, worked his butt off. And I don't think there's ever been a question of his work ethic, but he really poured himself into the offseason, a different offseason than the COVID one. He's able to travel out to Southern California, work with Josh Allen. He worked with a hand-eye coach, a visual, athletic visual coach who works with NHL and MLB players as well. And he gave Knox some technology to take back to Tennessee, where he lives in the offseason. And then he took it back with him to Buffalo to do different drills to improve his hand-eye coordination. And that was something that he credits as being a plus for him, and it's concentration. I don't know if that's why he's caught 5 touchdown passes and leads the team, but it couldn't hurt. And I also think the bond he has with Allen is very close. more so than I think a lot of folks realize. Allen never stopped believing in him. And I think Allen is a big reason that Knox maybe believed in himself more.
Well, see, that's even like with regard to beating the Chiefs, it could be the same type of thing that's taking place there. I don't know whether it's the actual drills that he does there with the hand-eye coordination person or whether or not he feels like he's put in the work. So he's out of his head a little bit more and then just able to execute because he's confident in those moments. Whatever it is, it's working for Dawson Knox. And then as a result for the Bills, you have covered this team for a long time. They have been through seasons where there have been reason for excitement about football in Buffalo. They've been through seasons where they have been excited about football, even when there were not reasons to be excited about football in Buffalo. This is one of the best fan bases in the country. What feels different to you, having witnessed a lot of that, about this team this year and how realistic the expectations might be?
Yeah, I think you put that very well. They went through this, of course, this long stretch, 17 years without a playoff appearance. And the history of the team with those, you know, four consecutive Super Bowls, the Jim Kelly, Bruce Smith, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed era, the Hall of Famers coming from that Marv Levy, Bill Polian. And enough distance started to be created to where that was just your fathers or grandfathers or grandma and mom's Bills and not our Bills. And the fan base, I think, first started to do what fan bases do. They adjust to the situation. Having a football team in Buffalo, having an NFL franchise, the brand was mattering a lot more than what was happening when that brand actually took the field. And I guess to sort of mask whatever emotional pain there was, people decided to hurt themselves by jumping on tables and parking lots and all that crazy stuff that happened. But actually, the event of going to the game became more important than the game. That's not what the Bills, of course, wanted. It benefited the team in no possible way. And I think what's happened here is finally, after a lot of not just the collective years, but looking at what they put together in and the coaching staff, the front office, there was legitimate dysfunction. Rex Ryan came in. You had the name, and I'm not citing this to pick on Rex, but he was more the name and the persona and more fun at press conferences than he really was at coaching the team. And you had Doug Whaley as the general manager, and there was just nothing really happening there that was encouraging to the franchise, and that something had to be redone. So Terry and Kim Pegula as owners finally got it right with obviously Sean McDermott bringing him in at 2017. They love the fact, Terry especially did, that Sean's wrestling background as a high school championship wrestler, the singular, that sense of purpose and work ethic, as Terry said, how much of a wrestler's life is pretty much a lonely existence to train right between matches. And it's not about, feeding off the glory of support, even though there's crowds cheering for you. It's not the same as a team sport, but that individual focus, and that got him, impressed him. And they made the great choice there by picking him. And then even another great choice in Brandon Bean. Now, they had worked together in Carolina, as you know, with Bean in the front office there, but Bean coming in to Buffalo really wasn't a true package deal with McDermott. Bean was a separate entity. He impressed the Pegulas with his portion as far as the interview process and what his vision was. But the two of them had merging visions of how a team should look, the kind of players they want. And Lindsay, I know this gets overused, culture building and all of that, but it's legit. You feel it. It's palpable among the players that in that locker room, that everywhere they go, they meet the McDermott Bean standard of what they want as personalities, as character, and of course, work ethic. You got to have talent. I'm not diminishing that, but I think it's a mixture of all these things, and the fan base, to take it back to that, recognizes this. They've seen enough reasons to be fooled. Call it, I don't want to say necessarily, well, I guess I will say snake oil salesman type of mentality, like, oh, this is going to be great, and really isn't. They've been through that enough. Now they're seeing something that did look substantive, sustainable, very much like those who remembered it, the Marv Levy, Bill Polian stuff back in the 90s. And yes, the confidence level is you've got the franchise quarterback, number one priority, but you've got this defense you've put together. The names are familiar. They've returned a lot of guys, so it's not a team with a revolving door. So there's a sense that this can stay good.
It feels like there are smart adults at the helm there.
Yes. Yes. Very well put. And that's what you have to have. And they didn't always have it. Smart adults is the way to put it. You don't ever really get a sense of panic when things go wrong. And you certainly don't get a sense of great euphoria when things go right. I thought they properly handled what happened last year, as bitterly disappointing as losing in Kansas City was in that AFC Championship game. It was methodical. Brandon Bean sat there a couple of days after that game and recited all the elements of what, you know, not only calling the Chiefs the gold standard, but what they needed to get better. And then look at the drafting that was done. I mean, you use your first two picks on defensive ends. One, Greg Rousseau, who played 15 games in his collegiate career, but this dynamic athlete, this long and incredibly, I mean, quick and all the athleticism. And I was skeptical that he would see a lot of playing time. And of course, you see what he does, last night in that tip and interception. But right along, he's been generating pressure. And that scheme that they had against the Chiefs, I feel like they were devising that scheme hours after that AFC Championship game. And it really was the Tampa approach to the Super Bowl, right? Two deep safeties, five underneath of defenders, you know, flood that secondary, give them nowhere to throw. Just rely on your front four to pass rush, as you talked about, only one blitz and 63 dropbacks, and then frustrate them. And I feel like all of that vision stuff, Lindsay, was there months in advance, a year in advance.
And then the discipline's there to see it through. So people we talked about people overreacting maybe a little bit to Josh Allen's start to the season. People will overreact potentially to this Chiefs loss. Well, frankly, probably the fact that they've lost three games in 21 days is what people will react to. I don't know. Do you think it is an overreaction, or do you think that there's legitimate cause for concern? Are they not going to be the Chiefs that we've known them to be for the last few years this year?
I think there's legit cause for concern. This defense is bad. I don't see where it's going to get better anytime soon. They had their moments in this game, which kind of surprised me. I thought actually for parts of the first half, okay, maybe we overreacted on how bad this defense really was. And maybe it's, but as the game unfolded, you saw the flaws, you saw the potential for it to be troublesome. But more concerning than that is how this offense has misfired in games, not just this game against Buffalo, the turnovers that have occurred in other games. And then I think the bigger, and looking at Patrick Mahomes, looking very human, not like the dominant force. My mom is almost 93 years old. She watched this game. She's a very avid fan. And her first words this morning, I thought this Patrick Mahomes guy was like supposed to be this real dynamic, special player and, Superman. And even she understood that. And I mean, like it's obvious to the naked eye that something wasn't right with number 15. Well, I think some of it is on him. A lot. Let's credit the Bills defense. But here's the other part. How about the injuries? How about the injuries that they're accumulating now with Tyreek Hill and Edwards-Helaire and the stinger for Travis Kelce? That list
Joe
was
Tooney and then, on the line.
Yeah, Tooney. Right. So it's a troublesome thing. Five games into it, when you got those key injuries on offense anywhere, but you got key injuries. They got some injuries on defense too. So yeah, I would be nervous as a Chiefs fan. Yeah.
I think all the points about the offense are totally valid. I wonder how much it might be that the offense is pressing or feels like they need to do too much as a reaction to what's happening on the defensive side of the ball, which is historically bad. So I got a stat from ESPN. that I think is crazy. So the most prolific offense in NFL history was the 2000 Rams. They averaged 7 yards per play. The Chiefs defense is averaging 7.1 yards allowed per play. That is awful. And it's really kind of head scratching because you look at like what's happening in the secondary. It's a lot of the same people as there were last year. And they weren't the best defense in the league last year, but they weren't this bad. So in some ways you kind of look at them and go, well, maybe they'll figure it out, because it's not like, oh, they're just a completely revamped defense and it's just not there this year. I can't figure out why they're so bad.
Yeah. And I think of like a Tyrann Mathieu. I think of, him being a special freakish talent, which he is.
Leader, all of it. Yeah.
A leader. But there's, even in him, I don't see the same thing. And I know what you're talking about. It probably shouldn't be maybe as bad as it is. And the other thing, too, can maybe be a little on the side of predictability. So Steve Spagnuolo, who is, a fine coordinator and I think comes up with good scheming and is effective at what he does. But I also felt last night he was at a loss. He was trying to almost too hard, to your point, of trying to make things happen. And maybe that is what I think that is naturally what goes on with teams. If one side of the ball is struggling, maybe the other side is trying to do a little too much. And I've seen it before, certainly with the Bills. Last year, their defense was almost, I'm not going to say non-existent, but it certainly wasn't what it was in 2019. And yet it wasn't a problem because the offense was rolling. We go back to the years when the Colts with Peyton Manning were as dominant as they were. They weren't always great in fact, the criticism of Bill Polian and Tony Dungy then was putting way too much in the investment on the offensive side and turning your back to the defense. That does happen, and the salary cap can force that. But the Chiefs on talent, I don't know that they should be this bad. And I guess when you don't have, a Frank Clark when you don't have, you have Clark, but you don't have other people up front, you're starting to maybe press and it's not just players. Coaches can do that too.
Yeah. So that offense goes into the game knowing they have to put up at least 30 points or else they're not going to have a shot, because the defense has allowed 29 points or more in every single contest this year. So the Bills, I think everyone's favorite in the AFC on this particular Monday morning post week 5 could change dramatically. It seems to every single week. Who do you see as the Bills' toughest competition in that conference?
Well, I think the AFC as a whole is so intriguing. There's tough competition up and down the board. Let's start with the obvious, the Los Angeles Chargers, Justin Herbert.
Take a moment to just acknowledge that the obvious is the Los Angeles Chargers, like how far they've come in such a short period of time. It's incredible that they're in this conversation.
With a first year head coach, changing coaches. I mean, here's Herbert 2 years in a row working with two different head coaches. So give them a lot of credit for what they've done and been able to do. But that was there was so much focus, obviously, Sunday Night Football, Chiefs, Bills. But that game of Chargers Browns had kind of steadily worked its way to being one you had to pay attention to for pecking order of AFC. And I'm not discounting where the Browns are. I like the game Baker Mayfield had there, and you had the two teams and those crazy stats of having that many points and that many yards, 500 yards, and still losing the game for Kevin Stefanski, another coach that I have great respect for. He's been such a difference maker.
That was a battle of two very smart coaches. That end sequence when Eckler was trying not to score and the Browns pushed him in, I was like, this is just perfection, right? Like both teams fully understand the circumstances that are happening right now and they're executing, and just people who love football, appreciate the analytics part of football also. I mean, that was like chef's kiss.
No question about it. It was the deeper thinking elements that I think we appreciate when we see that, because it goes beyond just watching great athletic plays. But I would also say that it was more than a little shocking to see how poorly the defenses perform. I mean, let's give credit to the offenses, but you know, Browns are supposed to have a really good defense, and so are the Chargers, and we didn't see them show up. So again, a little of, maybe that's what makes it also more intriguing, is to see, to know that both of those defenses can play well. But having said all that, those teams intrigue me. Baltimore, you know, and we know that they have got with Lamar Jackson, and it's probably, I think it's more than a little unfair that we talk about Justin Herbert, we talk about Josh Allen, we talk about Patrick Mahomes. Lamar Jackson's got to come up in this conversation in a big way. I saw a stat with him. He's 7-0 in October in his career, just throwing it out there. The only unbeaten guy like in his career, and it's, yeah, seven games. It's not the longest career, and Tom Brady's got a bunch of those wins, and you know, other top, Ben Roethlisberger. You can go through the list of iconic guys, but Lamar Jackson, and I believe Greg Roman has done such a smart job with him this year. Not that they were dumb before this, but I feel like they're getting so much more out of this talent with his throwing ability, his running ability, completeness. And I think he's become far more dangerous. And as he's learned and his ability to read and all the things that come, Josh Allen, I mean, for 2 years, nobody was, yeah, well, you know, let's see what he really is, because he makes a lot of mistakes, or he looks at, okay, and now we're talking about him as a top level guy. It does take a little time. Not everybody's Justin Herbert. Not everybody's Joe Burrow. And that's the other, I segue to, how do you like the way I did this, to Cincinnati. Another team that I'll put in this AFC conversation, Lindsay, even though maybe it would be nice to have a kicker who can maybe kick, you know, one out of, you know, 50 field goals.
It was a rough day.
Was a rough day. And if, when Mason Crosby's missing too, and you know that name, at three times, I mean, my God, that was amazing. But Cincinnati is going to have, I think, something to say about the AFC as well.
That's incredible. I mean, at the beginning of the year, I remember talking to people who covered the AFC North, and they would chuckle. I was like, I don't know. I mean, that's like a 4-team race. And they were like, well, it's a 3-team race, really. Like, let's be honest, you know, immediately just putting the Bengals right at the bottom. I kind of wondered, and I didn't like, I was not a big fan of the draft pick. I thought that they should have bulked up the line, but there's no arguing with the fact that the offensive weapons that the Bengals have are great. So if they can do anything defensively, like, they're building something there. They have a roster to be competitive. I don't know why we wrote them off at the beginning of the year.
No, well, and I guess we did, because, you know, the mindset is it's going to be, I mean, obviously Cleveland enters the conversation in a big way based on what they did last year, rightfully so. But then we look at Baltimore, and there's always something with Pittsburgh. I mean, you've got to at least think about them. But this year, they were the one being sort of set aside as the third team. And then, as you said, Cincinnati was just left for, okay, they'll bring up the rear. It's changed. Now, having said all that, we've got to bring up the fact that where did Pittsburgh's win over Denver come from? Because that wasn't something I was anticipating. I saw Pittsburgh week one against Buffalo. Nothing exciting about that game at all, or special. I say exciting about what they did. Or special about what they did. Buffalo still kicking itself, saying that was one we should never have lost, and they should be 5-0. But they did lose it. Their defense was solid. Ben wasn't special. He just stayed within himself. And then when it was over, I said, is Pittsburgh really that good? And they proved, obviously, the stumbling that they did afterward. But then they played Denver. And I was going to say, keep an eye, you know, we got to look at Denver and respect what Denver does. And I guess we kind of should do that. But let's give the Steelers a lot of credit, because it just could be that in their own way, a lot of new pieces on that team maybe find a way to gel.
Talking about the AFC North, and you brought up the Browns and the fact that we expected their defense in particular, the Chargers also, to look better yesterday in that 89 combined points showdown between those two teams. It makes me think of the Vikings, because a lot of what we saw from them last week, and then also the Browns offense, we were like, okay, the defenses just shut them down. And particularly, you're like, well, the Browns defense is very, very good. What I saw from Minnesota yesterday has me just straight up confused and a little bit frustrated. If I'm a Vikings fan, I am kind of frustrated, which is a weird emotion after a win that was heartbreaking for the Lions. Dan Campbell and all of his emotion in the post game. I continue to believe that the culture, and you mentioned that about the Bills, that the culture that they're building there in Detroit is something that will pay off next year, you know?
Yeah. I had a hard time watching Dan Campbell. I mean, I was hurt. I was kind of hurting for the guy.
It
was,
I know, me too.
Right. I started watching it and I said, okay, there's a reason they're showing this before. I didn't see it live, but then you could tell he's misty eyed and then he's choking up and I'm thinking, you know, this guy, okay, it is 0-5. He knows how this business works. He knows that I think, and maybe I'm over analyzing here, psychoanalysis that we always do in this business, but I just feel like a guy sees a quarter of the way through the season of a 17 game season, but he sees himself, okay, I'm 0-5, team's 0-5, but I'm 0-5. This is my shot. We've been close. We lost a 66-yard field goal. Now we lose this game by 2 points to a division rival. The tolerance isn't going to be very high for what we're doing here. Yet I still believe, and I think our guys are fighting, but that only gets you so far. Sad truth is 0-5 speaks a lot louder than how you got to 0-5. And with Minnesota, to your point of frustration, look, they lucked out. I mean, should they not be thankful? I thought Mike Zimmer looked like the most thankful human being. There was no way they were expecting the way that would turn out for them, just the way the game was going.
The fact a kicker took the heat off of him and not the other way around is incredible. It was not an impressive offensive performance by that Vikings team. It just wasn't.
Not at all. And it's supposed to be better. I mean, Kirk Cousins, the passing game, it's supposed to be better. It's shown capacity to be better, but that's not getting it done. I think in a game like that, you don't see in the Vikings at 2-3 that this is going to like take off like a rocket offensive.
I mean, I would argue too that it's not even so much Cousins and the passing game as much as a conservative approach offensively. Like at the end of the half, for instance, the first half, they had 40 seconds left, I think, in two timeouts, and they ran the clock out. And the fans were booing. And I was like, what are you doing? And you see teams do this, and I don't understand it. Because at this point, especially with analytics everywhere, and everyone just screaming, like, each play matters, right? Like, why would you give away an opportunity to pick up yards and then potentially points? And at the very least, put yourself in field goal range. It doesn't make sense to me to approach that game situation the way that they did.
No, Lindsay, I'm with you. And I think some of that, I don't want to oversimplify my reaction to that, but I think you've got a defensive head coach. You got a defensive rooted head coach. And he wouldn't be the first defensive rooted head coach who stuck to those principles, right, of we'll lean on the defense here. We won't take risks offensively, even if it made a lot more sense to utilize the time you got to try to get points and think that way. And a lot of analytics, most of football analytics, skews toward doing more to try to score, right? Which seems logical enough. But I mean, you know, those situations where you don't punt, where you take shots on fourth down and go for, I mean, just keep it rolling, keep it rolling. That's not been necessarily Mike Zimmer's way. And I think you'd have to be a persuasive. Now, we've talked about Buffalo as scoring as much as any team in the NFL can score at this point. I think they lead the league there. They've got a defensive-oriented guy in Sean McDermott. But Sean was around Andy Reid in Philadelphia, and I think and credits a lot of his education from that. And he trusts that he's got the right coordinator in a Brian Daboll who definitely will put pedal to metal when he has to or when he feels it's right. And he defers to that. It doesn't mean he won't be wrong. And I'm sure Sean and Brian have had their conversations. I think with Zimmer, it feels like that's just this is the show. This is how we're going to do it. And I'm not going to say analytics be damned because I don't know that there's anybody in the league who says that or really believes that. That's got to be a tool that you utilize. But yes, and the other thing, one more thing on Minnesota, that crowd, you talked about the crowd booing. Before that game, Zimmer made a big deal public, I mean, to the media, how excited he was to have a game at home, this divisional game at home, and we'll feed off the home crowd and we'll be fired up and, you know, skull and the whole thing. Well, yeah, you don't give them much, though, when you do that stuff with 40 seconds left.
So I see a book behind you. You have another book coming out, Vic?
I do. This guy over here, it's called Super Bowl Blueprints. And I had the extreme pleasure for the second time in the book writing to work with Bill Polian, who is just, I mean, as I've learned more football from him probably than anyone else, just by being around him all the time. I covered him in Buffalo and even after that. The first book we did, which was called The Game Plan, it was more about Bill's how you put a team together. It wasn't an autobiography. It was about how he did it. And he took stuff from the operational manuals he's put together, how you hire a coach, how you put together a staff, how you, again, selection of players, what you're looking for at different positions. It's the kind of thing that I think a lot, and I've heard this from a lot of younger personnel people, that they keep in the top drawer because it's helpful to them. And I would understand that. And the only credit I'll take is getting his voice in there his way in that book, because it's all Bill. This one, we did something different. And when Bill approached me on it more than a year ago, he said, you want to do another book together? He had gotten approached by a publisher. I said, sure. What's the idea? He goes, not sure. Let me think about it. Okay. And it's nice when a publisher says, just write a book for us. But when you're Bill Polian, he comes up with the idea of let's try to capture these iconic teams in football history and tell the story of how these Super Bowl teams were built, the blueprints of these teams were built. And it's I'll give one thing away. There's not a Patriots chapter in here, which I would say, wait a minute, how could you not? No, the Patriots are a volume. And it's still in progress. Bill Belichick is still coaching. Tom Brady is still doing what he's doing, of course, with Tampa Bay. But these are the Raiders teams. You're going to hear all from a lot of folks like, you know, Ron Wolf and Tom Flores talking about that. Mike Haynes. We were able to get 32 Hall of Famer, mostly Hall of Famers, to tell us the stories. And they were all incredibly cooperative. Terry Bradshaw and Mel Blunt and Mean Joe Green and Steve Young. And just go down the list, Art Rooney, the second, and telling these incredible stories of how the teams were put together and what were some of the keys to just kind of making it work in oral history format. So we spent, as I say, on Zoom calls like this, about 2.5 hours with each person, Bill Parcells. I could just keep naming Joe Gibbs. Fascinating, such an education, but a lot of work. And it's 400 pages, about 150,000 words. It could have been longer. The publisher basically put a ceiling and says, you guys got to like cut it off here or else the production costs are going to go far long. Save it for the next volume on this.
The sequel.
The sequel, but we had a lot. It was so good. So Bill's role, besides coordinating the interviews, and of course, you know, I'm no kidding here. Everybody who cooperated, their Hall of Fame fellow Hall of Famers with Polian. Polian calls up and says, "Can you help us out to do this?" They respond, yes. Which was great. Yeah. I love that. His entree made it perfect. Bill said, I'd like to think when we were setting up the project, he goes, I'd like to think of myself as the stage manager of our town, who is the narrator, right, of town. And I said, that's a great analogy of what you are. So he sets up each chapter, and then you have the voices interchangeable all the way through, weaving the story. Peyton Manning, because we have a Colts, obviously a Colts chapter with Bill. Tony Dungy, amazing. Tony shows up heavily in two places, of course, the Colts chapter, but the Steelers chapter, because he was a player and a coach for Chuck Knoll. And what I also loved, we brought people back to life, like Chuck Knoll is brought back to life through the voices of Tom Moore and others who worked with him and knew him well, intimately. Al Davis, brought back to life in the Raiders chapter by various voices, incredible anecdotes. Mike Haynes, just giving us Tom Flores, just giving us these incredible Ron Wolf. And then Ron shows up. So we have this West Coast 1 and 2 chapter. Bill Walsh, we bring him back to life. And we actually had some wonderful transcripts from him, from some radio interviews he did. And he and Steve Young and others bring him back to life. But we also have a West Coast 2, which is how the West Coast had gone from San Francisco with Mike Holmgren. Of course, he helps bring Bill to life. And then he takes it to Green Bay. And we tell that story on how the West Coast and Ron Wolf, of course. And so if you're the football junkie that we all, that you and I are and others are, I think you're going to enjoy it. And again, I love Bill's mind. The way the football mind works is just fascinating.
So. Let me ask you this. Having talked to all of those people about team building and having success in that department, did you pick up on any kind of theme, any kind of through line? Like all of these teams had this in common?
Yes. What they had was, and I think the core of it is Chuck Knoll. Trust what you believe. Trust your plan. And Tony Dungy would say this too. Do what we do, right? Worry about do what we do. And it sounds simple, but it's a bigger deal than that. Because what happens when you say do what we do and do it well? Well, if you're losing and you're having any kind of rough patches, you know, people are telling you what you're doing stinks. Do something else.
Abort. Yeah.
Everybody, Chuck Knoll heard that, obviously, ignored it eventually, immediately. And eventually it pays off. The struggles of some of these other teams, Bill Walsh's methods and approach were not necessarily they weren't accepted as Steve Young had a great anecdote about Bill Walsh being the first Silicon Valley CEO before there were Silicon Valley CEOs that we were all fascinated about his approach being ahead of the game, worrying more than just about football, that there were human beings involved, how you work with them. So the common thread is you have these very smart people who understood the depth, first of all, trusted their plan and had a deeper understanding about the human condition. And Chuck Knoll would say, you don't have to just be extraordinary, but do what you do well and then do that extraordinarily well. Just stay in your, stay in your lane, but do it exceptionally well. You don't have to come in being exceptional, but you can get there if you just consistently approach it this way. So yeah, I think you get a lot of common, Mean Joe Green talked about how early on he couldn't understand why Knoll kept saying, we're going to do it this way and keep doing it this way. Coach, we're losing. What are we doing here? And it was awful those early Steeler years when they were drafting in the 70s, all these players who would be great Hall of Famers.
When does the book come out?
So the book comes out Kindle and the various ebook ways you can download it in mid. Where are we now? Another week in October here. So it's soon, and then in hardcover, it'll be November. It'll be next month in the hardcover edition, and you can go to Amazon. You can actually order it now on Amazon if you'd like. Or wherever you get books, so it's great. I've done a bunch of these. This I think is number 11. I've worked with a variety of people who have been I'm the blessed one that have trusted me to help tell their story or help capture their voice. But this one with all these different people and hearing it, as I say, it was such an education, and I'd find myself, before I'd start actually working on the book, just digesting what was said. And as someone who just loves this game, it made me love it even more. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to read it, Vic. Good luck with the book. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Lindsay.
can follow Vic on Twitter at Vic Carucci, and look out for the book entitled Super Bowl Blueprints with Bill Polian. One thing I did want to follow up about that I kind of saw differently than Vic, but the conversation veered away pretty quickly and I didn't want to circle back too far after the fact, but the Dan Campbell thing, the emotion in his postgame press conference, it is possible that some of that was him surveying his own individual landscape, but I didn't sense that it was. And I think that that is what specifically moved me about it. I feel like he is all in on his guys, and his actions, I think, have sent that message consistently. He doesn't have the pieces to win now, right? And he lost one of the pieces that he had yesterday in Quintez Cephas, who broke his collarbone, is probably out for the rest of the year. I know that some people will see the tears and they will roll their eyes and they'll think that he's all over the place with this kneecap stuff and the coffee stuff and now this. What I see, though, is a guy who's consistently being himself in every possible moment. It feels like an authentic form of leadership. It's different than the type of leadership that we typically see, but it feels authentic. And I think that that will play well in the locker room and is ultimately key to buy-in. If they feel like he's really invested in them and believes in them, and as we saw yesterday, is disappointed for them when it doesn't work out, I think that will lead to results eventually. And if I were in charge in Detroit, I wouldn't even think of moving on from him this year, whether they win a single game or not, because I think that there's something there. Quick note about Monday Night Football and a third team that is invested tonight in the Colts-Ravens results. It's the Eagles, who are getting perilously close to losing a first-round pick because of Indy's poor play. You'll remember when Philly traded Wentz to the Colts. They got a conditional second-round pick in return. Well, that pick can turn into a first-round pick if Carson Wentz plays 75% of Indy's snaps this season. But since they're 1-3 and perilously close to dropping out of playoff relevancy, there's not much motivation for Indy at a point to get Wentz those snaps. So Philly needs Indy to win, ideally just enough to keep the playoffs in their sights so they keep playing Wentz, but ultimately lose enough games that the pick is a higher pick in the first round. If the draft was right now, it would be the 7th overall pick, but there's virtually no chance it stays that way. Anyway, that'll do it for us today. Working on something for Wednesday that I think will be interesting in light of all the missed kicks this weekend. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also subscribe, please, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app. Free for most subscribers. Just download it today. Tap podcast. Boom, there we are. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen. And we'll see you again on Wednesday.
SiriusXM Podcasts.